Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ideas in writing.
Hello, I'm Phil Holden, and this is Ideas in Writing, the podcast about books, words, and why people write them and how people write them. And that's especially true of this, the 9th episode, can you believe it, where I'm talking to the Emmy award-winning author David Quantick. It's a name you might know, but you probably don't have very much of a mental picture of him. He's one of the creative minds behind The Day-to-Day, or is he? Veep, he definitely is, and a series of really insightful books about writing, as well as his own radio and television projects and novels. Since talking to David, I've now read All My Colours, but at the time I'd read Night Train, which we concentrated on, and it's a strange, unsettling book, difficult to categorise because it has something of the sci-fi dystopia about it, as well as being horror and some kind of psychological thriller, which opens with the central character waking up in the dark with no memory of how she got there, on a train hurtling towards, well, no one knows. Now, normally when I do these shows, I edit them to make the conversation sound effortless, but mainly to make me sound intelligent and witty, and that takes a long time. In this case, talking to a comedy writer, I made the mistake of trying to tell a joke. It wasn't an original one. Some friends of mine will recognize it, but it landed like, well, let's just say it never landed. So after the recording, I jokingly said to David that I cut that bit out, but he insisted that I keep it in, and I think he thought it was even funnier than the attempted joke itself, and he's probably right. So I stand by my embarrassment, and you can listen to the full audio effect of a fatal case of cringing right at the end of this recording. We discussed all kinds of things about surviving in the 80s on supplementary benefits, the inventors of such words as saddo and shitgibbon, why being a writer is like doing a poo, how you go about writing the next Harry Potter, why he realised his book Night Train might be based on The Wizard of Oz, and it's an interesting diversion on what changes you make when you adapt a book for a film. I decided that this kind of comedy David writes and his approach to his storytelling was summed up by the word absurdism. And David, absurdly, came along with the word Wednesday, which word led to my recorded death at the end of here. So anyway, here we are, absurdism Wednesday with David Quantick. So, hello, David Quantick. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Philip. Nice to meet you.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Are you keeping busy?
Yeah, I am. Lockdown hasn't really affected me work-wise. I just still sit in front of a computer all day typing.
Yeah, how does that feel? Do you get bored with that?
Not really, no. I don't think I'd be doing it if I was bored with it.
I think, the reason I wanted to talk to you, I think, and perhaps you wanted to talk to me, was particularly about Night Train, which is the latest novel of yours. And I think maybe we'll come on to that later on. But I have to say, I enjoyed it very much. And I as I think a number of other people have commented, I read it in one sitting because I wanted to find out what happened. Is that a common experience with that book?
I have seen, like you, a few people say that. Yeah, I'm quite surprised because it doesn't seem that short.
No, I don't think it was. I don't think it was a comment on how short it was. I think it was, you know, desperately wanting to get to the next chapter and find out what, you know. Well, as I say, we'll come back to it. Maybe we'll come back to it, hopefully towards the end. The other thing, I mean, you're on Twitter like me, so it's I always feel when I speak to someone on Twitter that I sort of know them, and actually, you probably don't. You just know kind of what gets them angry, but that's how we made contact. And I've got copies of your book here, and I knew your name as a television writer. First and foremost, and do you consider yourself as that?
I just think of myself as a writer, really, but most of my career it's all been a bit mixed, really. I started off writing about music in 1983, then in 1986 I started writing sketches for television, so they've kind of run in parallel, really. I still do some music journalism, but now I try and write novels as well, so just a writer, really.
Yeah. We're the same age. I think you're probably in the school year before me. You were born in Yorkshire, is that right? And then...
Yes, I was born in Wortley on the outskirts of Sheffield. Yeah, my mother had moved there to have me because she came from a community in Long Eaton. I was adopted by my birth parents, my mum and dad, who were from Devon, and they moved back to Plymouth with my sister shortly afterwards. So I've got no connection with Yorkshire, but it is quite nice to pretend I'm from Yorkshire to annoy people from Yorkshire who think that being from Yorkshire is in itself interesting.
I think the majority of guests I've had on the podcast have actually been born in Yorkshire, strangely.
That is bizarre. Where were you born?
It is bizarre. Well, I was born in Lancashire, the other side of the Pennines. But we must have overlapped at UCL. You were at University College at the same time as me then, I guess.
Oh, right, yes. What were you doing at UCL?
Anthropology.
Oh, right. Yeah, I probably wouldn't have met you.
No, I was in that little building on the corner, you know, by Mallet Street.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a little house on the end there. Where was the law section? Is that the Bartlett School or is it something?
No, it was a place called Thorn House. It was opposite the Quaker building, so... It was away from the bulk of the college, but if you fired a rocket from Euston Station at the Quaker building, it would hit Thorn House shortly afterwards. It was right. A nice sort of 1930s Art Nouveau or Deco building, and most of the law students never left it or went into UCL, but me and my friends used to like going to the student union, and I used to do the discos there for a while, so...
Oh, did you? That sort of, was it like a four-story building, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the headquarters of the Free French during World War II, apparently.
Was it? Because I did work in the bar there for a while.
Oh, right.
Not that I remember much about it. Did you ever get involved in the University of London Union on
I wasn't involved. Mallet Street? Well, I mean, I was involved in the sense that I used to go there and see bands.
Yeah.
In the post-punk era. And I used to see Ricky Gervais in there a couple of times, but I think I'd known Ricky at UCL very slightly, but he looked quite different when he was working at ULU. And a couple of times after that, I met him and didn't recognise him. I think he was quite annoyed.
So, I mean, you were clearly interested in music. Would you describe yourself as a music nerd?
More interested in the music. Yeah, I would say that I don't know about upset. I don't really care about, you know, records or record collecting, but I really do love music, yeah, and have a large record collection. But most of my music is on a computer now because vinyl's all right, but it's, you have to get up.
Yes, yeah. But so were you the same about comedy, or was comedy not really a kind of a major thing in your time at university?
It's just different. I mean, with comedy, yeah, there are people that I was really obsessed with and shows that I really liked. But I think at that point, unless you were American, comedy wasn't a thing you were a nerd about. Now it's got it's got a bit excessive. People constantly going on about great comedians and analysing sketches and stuff like that and slightly fetishizing it. But at the time, comedy was just what existed. And a lot of comedians like, I don't know, Bob Monkhouse and Frankie Howard, who are very talented, were just considered, you know, mainstream light entertainers. They weren't these cool cult figures that they have become.
Yeah.
So it was different. Music was more divided, more divisive.
Mm.
You know, you had cool bands and commercial bands and all kinds. Whereas with comedy, until alternative comedy came along, it was by and large, you know, everything was just comedy and funny. There were exceptions, you know, there was the Oxbridge lot. But even then, you'd see John Cleese on the Les Dawson show. So, yeah, music and comedy were talked about in different ways in those days, in that one was talked about and the other wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to Rory Bremner the other day talking in another interview, talking about how when he was at King's, comedy clubs were springing up, and that was, you know, he could go and do three shows a night. And I was completely unaware of that happening when I was in London at the time, you know, for those 3 or 4 years. But it was clearly happening because it was exactly the same time you and I were there.
Well, in the union, not to obsess about UCL, but in the student union, there would be lunchtime concerts. I remember seeing Alexei Sale. I remember seeing Paul Merton. I remember seeing a very fat man who put his stomach in a plastic washing basin. I can't remember his name. He was very good. But yeah, we used to get some of that. And I think, like you, well, that's an interesting thing. I didn't really go to comedy shows. Wasn't really aware of that circuit, but I went to bands obsessively.
Mm.
You know, I go and see if I could afford it, a band every week, maybe twice. Whereas, and again, student life, it's on your doorstep. You know, it comes to you.
Yeah.
Oh, here comes some entertainment. You know, I won't go anywhere to see it because, you know, it'll come to the... I remember being quite affronted that bands often wouldn't play student unions because, you know, they were obviously gigs for students only. And at that time, I think I thought that was quite a sensible idea, whereas as a member of the public, I would probably disagree with that intensely.
Yeah. And so you I gather you quite rapidly decided that law wasn't your subject or wasn't going to be your career.
No, I wasn't very good at it. I think I realised quite early on, I had a minor revelation that I could be a solicitor, which I didn't want to be, or a barrister, which I didn't have the ability to be, or the money. And there I was in London, and I thought about changing courses, but didn't. But I was in London, and I was getting paid by the state and slightly by my parents to live in London very cheaply, and obviously wasn't going to get a better life than that. So I stayed and finished the degree, and then had no idea what to do with my life.
So what were your options then? What did you think your options were?
Well, I took the civil service exam and did very badly. So that became clear to me that if I was a civil servant, I wouldn't get to hang out in the British Library. I'd be quite a low echelon civil servant, and that would be boring. And so I wrote to the editor of the NME telling him how bad the NME was. And he wrote back and asked me if I wanted to do some writing. So I did. So with that and signing on, claiming supplementary benefit, gave me a lifestyle.
When you wrote that, when you got the reply from the then editor, can you cast your mind back to how that felt? Was it kind of, did you look at this as an opportunity, a big opportunity, or was it just, I don't know, I mean, how did you see it?
Well, I've got to be honest and say I can't remember at all.
I remember
going into the Virgin Megastore in New Oxford Street, and buying a copy of The Enemy with my first review in, and being really excited until I bought it. And then obviously the moment I bought it, it was like, oh, it's just paper.
Yeah.
But trying to be excited. But no, I was really excited at the prospect of a review appearing when it had actually happened. And it was quite an odd time for a while because we were very poor. Me and my flatmates lived in a very cheap flat that had no phone. So I used to go and queue up to for the phone box at the end of the street to call the editor of the NME, who may not even have been at his desk when I called. And I think we may have set up times to call. And I used to call up and ask for work.
Yeah.
Quite extraordinary, like living in a village.
Yeah. Were you doing other work at the same time, though, to make ends meet? Or was it just...
No.
That was your thing?
I had written a short story for City Limits magazine and got 50 quid, and that was brilliant. And then I started doing reviews for them. But without the dole, without the supplementary benefit and housing benefit, I wouldn't have been able to live because I was making about £30 a week from writing. And I think my rent was, I don't know, I can't remember, but probably not enough to live on.
Yeah. But yeah, casting my mind back, it was, I mean, it seems very odd now that students, I remember in the holidays, signing on and that seems really odd now, doesn't it, that you could get that support. And
yeah, I mean, I just grew up with a generation where we took it for granted, but
yeah, for sure.
And it was a different culture, but no, you could say, I mean, I came from a holiday town, well, a tourist town, so in the summer I got a job, and they were all quite weird jobs, you know, cleaning in Royal Marine camps or working in souvenir shops or hiring fishing rods, things like that to people.
Yeah,
that was quite nice. But yeah, I think I just remember Christmas was the big one, the end of the winter term, you just go and sign on and go home. But it is very odd. I mean, nowadays students have to pay to be educated and end up in debt, and that seems to me ridiculous.
Yeah, and almost inevitably have to spend a lot of their time working as well as trying to do all the other things you do at university.
Yeah, it's not great.
But you, so the sort of, I guess, the transition from being some kind of music journalist to writing comedy, how did that happen?
I do remember that I was trying to write stuff. And all I remember is that I sent some stuff to Spit In Image.
Oh, yeah.
And I sent three sketches, and Jeffrey Perkins, a producer, who was quite a big figure in comedy, he produced Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and he produced Father Ted, an awful lot of shows in the 80s and 90s. And he wrote back to me and said he liked one of the sketches, which they bought. And that obviously encouraged me. I couldn't get much else on. I got the odd bit on Spit In Image, but I couldn't get anything else off the ground. So I was still mostly a music journalist, but I do maintain my friend Kath Carroll, who was a musician and a journalist. I remember being at her house and watching some grim comedy and her saying to me that I, as in me, could write better than that. And that was kind of a good thing to hear, because instead of somebody saying you're good or you're bad, just saying you can write as well as this that's on television. And that was like, oh, yeah. So I don't have to be good. I just have to get on television, or just have to be better than this.
Did you agree with her at that time?
I can't remember. I mean, I thought I was great. I've always said, you wouldn't, if you don't think you're great, you wouldn't do it. This world isn't really full of writers who go, oh, I'm quite good at writing. I should probably let people know how reasonably good I am.
I don't know. You may be surprised. I think there's probably quite a few people who write and apologise for writing. And I don't know. It's difficult to be objective about it, I guess, in the end, isn't it? Because you only need some people to like what you write.
Oh, you only need the people who pay you to like it.
Yeah. So you ended up doing something with Armando Iannucci. That's about the same time, was it?
That's Spitting Image was about 1986. Armando was about 89, 90, because at the NME, I think there must have been, I think I'd written reviews that were trying to be funny, because there was a tradition of that. People like Julie Birchall had been extremely excoriating but funny. Danny Baker was a very funny writer. So there was a tradition of that. So I used to do that and take the mickey a bit. And then a writer called Stephen Wells, who was a seething Wells, a ranting poet, who was quite extreme and very abrasive, said to me something like, "You're the only person here who's almost funny. Let's do something together." So we did a column for several years called Culture Vulture. It changed its name a lot. It was called Ride the Puffin and Ride the Lizard. And we enjoyed doing that. And Armando Iannucci read it. And yeah, and then he wrote to us and said he was doing a radio show called On the Hour and invited us to contribute to it. So we did.
So when you were writing those columns, were you consciously sort of not copying, but I mean, aiming at a particular style? Was there a particular writer that impressed you and you wanted to emulate?
Not really, because we'd both been writing for a while. We both had our own styles, and we sort of evolved this joint style that was, well, pretty much Stephen's style, which was very explosive and extreme with swearing and exclamation marks and mocking. I mean, the main thing was mockery, because, well, The Enemy wasn't that reverential, but it could be quite serious about things that it liked, whereas we were just rude.
Right.
And conversely, we liked things that other Enemy didn't like. So we liked Kylie Minogue when people didn't really like pop, and we'd mock Steve Albini and Marky Smith and Morrissey, all these kind of readers' totems who were...
Right.
We'd just take the mickey out of them, and it was very effective. I remember Marky Smith asking the editor if me and Stephen were a gay couple, which was his way of coping with the fact that we were taking the mickey out of him. Yeah, it was great. We just used to mock people. Stephen invented the word saddo in those pages. I invented the word shit gibbon in those pages. So we contributed to the language.
Wow, yeah.
We got killed in an episode of Judge Dredd in 2000 AD comic by a writer who didn't like us enjoying Kylie Minogue.
Wow.
It was a really nice time.
I hope you've got a copy of that comic.
Oh, I have. I've got it framed on a wall.
Yeah, that's very cool. So that sort of, those sort of columns translated into the stuff you did on radio. Was that, now I'm trying to remember who it was, Collins and McConey, was it? Stuart McConey?
Yeah, there was an element of that that I'd taken from, I mean, me and Stephen worked together for a while, but he was quite a radical. He was a radical socialist, and unlike me, he couldn't really bring himself to work for, you know, the kind of commercial TV shows that I didn't mind about. So I had a more conventional route, but I still retained a lot of that writing attitude. So the columns I did for Collins and McConey, you're quite right, were an extension of that. They were just me, yet again, being rude about Marky Smith and Morrissey, and Paul Weller joined the panoply as he revived his career. And that was a lot of fun. And that ended up being a column in Select magazine, also called Quantix World.
All right.
I still do columns. Mine are a bit nicer now, but I do a column in Record Collector, which is in that tradition, but it's more of an old man's version, talking more about music and liking things, which is a new development.
I hadn't heard them first time round, and I looked up some of them, because there are some audios online of those, Quantix World. I don't know whether you know
that. Yes, I've heard them, yeah.
Put me in mind of some of Charlie Brooker's kind of rants on his TV show. So I don't know whether he's stolen that shtick from you.
Well, I think there's only one way of really writing a column like that. So I think we're coming from similar directions.
So to come back to On the Hour, what did you contribute to that? Did you go into a writer's room and get mixed up with other writers and told to contribute to an outline, or how did that actually work?
We go in, and Armando's always operated a kind of two or three tier system. I think we'd go in, and he would tell us what the show wanted that he would have worked out with people like Peter Bainham or Chris Morris, and Stephen and I would go back, and you know, we'd write, say, a monologue for Alan Partridge, or say an item about a financial crisis. We didn't really get a lot used because I don't think we had a handle on the house style of the show. So we may have had nothing in the show. I'm not entirely sure. I tend not to talk about that because I like people to think that I wrote all of it with Stephen. But I honestly don't know. I mean, it's quite weird because I can say that I wrote loads of Alan Partridge very early on, but I don't think a word of it was used.
Right.
And when it came to the day to day, Stephen and I worked on that, and we had more input in the sense, I think we wrote a scene where Alan put his hand on a woman's bottom. We wrote in a famous routine called War, which is one of the biggest set pieces in the day to day. We wrote a cat on a shelf that caused a truce.
And where did that come from?
Oh, it's just some troops had found a cat on a shelf and they stopped fighting to look after the cat.
Actually, while you're talking about Alan Partridge, you'll be aware of Richard Herring's constant kind of chipping away at this, the idea that he invented, or maybe he and Stuart Lee invented Alan Partridge, and he never got credit for that.
Yeah, I've heard about this. I think they reached a rapprochement in that Armando was directed Stuart Lee's comedy shows and stuff like that.
Mm.
But, I mean, all I know is I didn't invent Alan Partridge, so it's of no interest to me.
Oh, about that time, of course, there was the writer's room, wasn't there, in, I don't know whether it was called that, in the BBC Broadcasting House. Did you ever go there?
Well, there was a room. I think it had wood panelling.
There was a sort of open invitation for writers to contribute to Weekending or one of those kind of shows.
Yeah, I went to a Weekending meeting once when Armando was producing it briefly. It was all right. It was just one of those ones. There were a lot of non-commissioned writers were there, and it was a bit odd.
Yeah.
Well, some people would be good and some people would be like, oh, I saw a thing in the paper that would make a good joke. And I think somebody said that was 6 months ago and they said, oh, was it? I don't know. It was a long time ago. And
okay, well, in that case, let's zip through your CV much more quickly, because you ended up, I think, writing, I mean, all kinds of things, contributing to Brass Eye as well, which I suppose kind of follows on from the day to day, and a couple of other Chris Morris things. When you contribute to those things, I mean, how much is it, like you're saying with On the Hour or the day to day, you kind of write something and don't know if it's going to be used, or are you more involved in the storyline and the decisions as to what to include? Did that change?
No. I mean, I've never had a job. This is the main thing. I was never on the staff at the NME. When I left college, I didn't have a job. me and Stephen were contributing stuff to On the Hour. And when I worked with Jane Busman, who I met on a pilot for a show that was never made called Now What? Yeah, when I met Jane, we worked together, but we were on the staff of a Graham Norton show. But by and large, we wrote for the Farce Show, and we basically used to send them sketches. And then I just remember being phoned up and somebody going, this is Paul. And I was saying, Paul who? He goes, White House, you idiot. So that was the charming level we worked on with him. But that was great. But no, I mean, almost all my career has been sending things in and will it get used? Unless it was, you know, my own show or a show I did with Jane. And the same with Brass Eye. Chris is brilliant to work with. Brass Eye, we'd go to his office, and if it was sunny, sit on his roof or go to the pub, and he would tell us directly what he was after. And then later on with Brass Eye Special, there was a bit more trickle down. But most of the shows I've worked on have been a trickle down thing, you know, except more recently, not to go over everything I've done, but like on the things I've done with Armando in the 21st century. Sometimes you'll be writing gags, but a few times, you know, I've my name on my own co-written episodes of Veep.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But most of it has just been, unless it's my show, by and large, has been, here's what we want you to do, try this. A bit like leafleting, you know, here's a pile of leaflets, go and see if anyone wants them.
Yeah, speaking of which, did you ever do the Edinburgh Fringe thing?
With Collins and McConey, we did a show called Lloyd Cole Knew My Father.
Right.
Which we did 2 weeks of that. Steve Coogan said it was the best thing he'd ever seen at Edinburgh, but I suspect he was tired when he said that. And we got a Radio 2 series out of it. So,
oh, right, that's good.
That's a really good show. It's out there somewhere.
Yeah. So I'm getting the impression that a lot of the writing, kind of on your writing CV, divides into kind of different kinds of work, doesn't it? Because you see something, you kind of contribute something on spec, or somebody invites you to contribute and you still don't necessarily know if they're going to use it. Or as you say, occasionally it's your thing. It's your, you know, you've been commissioned to create something and you have much more kind of control and input, or and I guess responsibility as well. Is that the case?
Yeah, there's all different kinds of things, really. Sometimes it's quite nice to just send the odd joke in. That way you don't get the blame if the show goes badly. I did a show called Broken Arts on Radio 4, which was a massive, massive flop. And I was able to take the full credit for that. So it is swings and roundabouts.
Do you get, I don't know whether this may be a question of your kind of seniority in the business, but do you get paid for stuff that's not used, as it were? So, you send, well, maybe it's different in your early days. Obviously, I don't know how it works. So, you send in an idea for a sketch. Does somebody pay you?
Well, it totally depends. There's a thing which is very common now called a buyout, which is simply that you are hired and everything you write belongs to the show and you can work your backside off or you can do very little. It has no effect on the amount of money you get. That's extremely common, especially if the show is one where people like to believe that the star wrote it. So if you watch a show, I won't name any, where the writers are credited as script associates or program associates.
Right.
That's because if you're credited as writers, that might affect your legal status or your financial status, and also might affect the star of the show who believes that he or she wrote the show. By and large, the BBC used to have a bizarre system of payments for radio where you would get paid more if you had been doing it longer.
Oh, really?
Which led to the absurd position of me and Jane Busman working on a show receiving different rates of payment for the same sketches. So hopefully that's gone now. The main thing is it doesn't matter what system you're on, you won't make any money unless it's in America.
So it comes to my question. I think I asked this question of Ian McMillan, obviously in a slightly different context, but how do you make a living as a writer?
Well, you just do lots of work. Yeah, I did an interview with Gillian Reynolds, who's brilliant, the radio writer, and she asked me if I had a gambling problem because I did so much work and I must clearly need the money. But you just work a lot. And because I come from music journalism, I was used to weekly deadlines and I was used to writing a great deal of stuff overnight. So the whole thing of the author sat down writing a word and crossing it out, it's always seemed a bit silly to me. If I've written a word, I'm not getting rid of it because that's one word I don't have to write, so I'll write some more. Yeah, you just work all the time. And so, I mean, I really admire people like Chris Morris, who will have an idea for a film and will work on nothing else. And once he's made that, will then start. And he's made, he's made two full-length features. I couldn't do that. I mean, I haven't made any features, so maybe I've got things a bit confused. But I rather prefer the Armando Iannucci plan of make a film, make a TV series, write a book, do a radio series.
Yeah.
Because if you've got the time, and you should have, then you should try and fill it.
It seems, I guess, this is not it's not rocket science in one sense, that lots of people, and again, I think Ian McMillan said something very similar. He just wants to keep writing. He just, it's a muscle that he has to use.
Yeah, I mean, I've always written. Even when I was a kid, I wrote. I just like writing. I don't like it, but I think it's... I wrote a book about writing called How to Write Everything, and another one.
I was going to come on to that, yeah. And so how do you write anything? I mean,
well,
was it How to Write Anything or Everything?
Well, there's two, and in the second one, How to Be a Writer, because that was a different thing. I interviewed loads of people about writing, and Captain Moran said that basically being a writer is like doing a poo. You have to do it. And sometimes it feels nice and sometimes it's not. It's very difficult. And it is like that. It's like being sick. It's like a bodily function. You have to get it out. And yeah, I'm sure not everyone feels like that. And I'm sure there are lots of brilliant writers who don't. But I find it's a good way of shutting my head up.
Right. Is that an issue for you?
Yeah, I do think it's a good way of... I think some people find it difficult to cope with the chaos of existence. And I find that writing, especially even if it's making things up, makes me feel a lot happier because you're creating order. There is no order. The universe is completely random up to a point. But writing things makes you feel better.
Do you buy that, or I accept what you're saying. I'm just wondering if you at some stage think what I'm writing could make a difference or could make things better for other people as well, or is that not an issue?
I don't think so. It took me a long time to get round to writing because I thought, what's the point? Everything's been written. What does this add to anything?
Yeah.
So as I say, when my friend Kath said, oh, you could do better than this, it was like, oh, okay. Well, this is on television. I write things to make money and so that people will enjoy them. And sometimes I write things just because I've been told to. I suppose that's money. The weird thing is realizing that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, nobody cares if you write it. But you learn a lot from reading Amazon reviews of books because it's clear that people see, unless it's just malicious, people read a book for loads of different reasons, and the reviews will say things like, you know, oh, I enjoyed this. This was more exciting than I thought. I wanted a bit of a thrill. Some people are looking for meaning in books. Some people just want to kill a half an hour. Some people specialize in reading horror. Mm. There's millions of different reasons, and, you know, it's like finding a partner. You just trundle along, and if you find someone who likes it, we used to, at the NME, me and Stuart and Andrew used to mock bands because they used to say things like, there's always been a dance element to our music. But the thing they always said was, we make music for ourselves, and if anyone else likes it, that's a bonus.
Mm.
And while that's true, it's also drivel because people make music to be successful or to be liked or to get girls or boys. And if anyone else likes it, they're delighted.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd love to write the next Harry Potter or the next Miranda or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I'm able to, so.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, I mean, you certainly can't do it intentionally, can you? At least I don't think you can.
Well, you can have hit TV shows if you've got the right formula, but it's easier with that because you put famous people in it for a start and that gives you a something else, or you hit popular trends. But, yeah, when J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter, she obviously wanted it to be a huge hit and she'd obviously planned it, but I can't say if she was surprised or not, but I don't think anybody expected it to be the biggest. If you had a time machine and said in 20 years time the biggest book in the world will be a children's series about a boy wizard, or in 20 years time the biggest adult book in the world will be about a woman who likes to have a man do unpleasant things to her in an office, which 50 Shades of Grey. Then, I mean, 50 Shades of Grey is one of my favourite pop things. That
is it?
Well, just because E.L. James, who wrote it, who worked for Vic and Bob, bizarrely, worked for Pet Productions.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think she was a production coordinator, but she used to write fan fiction based on the Twilight movies for her own entertainment. And then, I don't know the process, decided to publish them. Obviously, couldn't publish her own Twilight fiction because of copyright, so adapted the characters out of that.
And it was
world.
Online originally.
It was online,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think she had any intention of world class wealth and fame, apart from hope, but that's what happened because, right, rambling a bit, but when I wrote How to Be a Writer, I interviewed two writers, Ben Aronovich and Andrew Cartmell, and they said to me, the only way to write the next Harry Potter is to have done it before Harry Potter came out.
Yes, yeah.
Because otherwise it's just a cash-in and people are like, can't be bothered with that.
Hmm.
So that's the secret of writing, is to accidentally guess what's going to be massive 3 years before you write it.
So you may as well write what you want.
Yeah.
And hope that it, yeah.
I mean, there's a middle ground. I mean, I have friends who write detective fiction, thriller fiction, you know.
Yeah.
Their genre fiction is great because genres, yeah, it'd be very I can understand writing a horror novel just for yourself, but writing a police procedural for yourself would be a bit odd because it's a very commercial market.
Yeah.
It'd be like writing a soap opera for yourself.
Yeah.
Coming up with EastEnders and just, you know, performing it for your friends.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking about the next big thing because I read one of the reviews of your books. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to read it myself. I can't remember whether it was The Mule or another one where it was likened to Dan Brown, but funny.
Yes.
Was that The Mule?
That was The Mule, yeah. Yes, that was a nice review. It's not really true. But it was in a way because it was about a man pursuing an art treasure to Paris. So in that resembles, in that sense it does. But then I've just been pointed out on Twitter that both the films Back to the Future and The Terminator feature a plot where a man goes back in time only for his mother to fall in love with him.
Yeah, so, well, you know, I mean, if you believe some, if you believe some script writing gurus, there's only so many stories.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Kermode's TV series was really good because it would show you that a romantic comedy might have the same plot as a heist movie, and vice versa. There are only so many stories. I don't think there's only seven.
But then, what becomes more important is the kind of, I guess, the certainly the skill of the writer, and I think also the voice of the narrator, the kind of voice of the book. You know, you can tell if a book has a consistent voice throughout, and I think that you have to kind of like that voice, that person.
Well, I think this is, yeah, it's like the New Statesman used to do, writing parody contests, you know, write this in the style of Graham Greene. I always enjoyed that. Because the thing is, a book by Martin Amis, a book, I mean, oh, here's one. There's a novel by Kingsley Amis called One Fat Englishman, and it's about a fat English guy goes to America and is horrified by things and has sex with people. And to some extent, that's the plot of Money by Martin Amis.
Yeah.
And it always interests me when you see how different people deal with completely different subjects. Armando's David Copperfield's completely different to David Lean's David Copperfield, and so on and so forth. So I think that when people do buy something that I've written, it's because they like the sound, as you say, of my voice.
Yeah. And I think there is a one of the things, I don't know whether this is a compliment or not, I'm just trying to think of the way of saying it, because I think there's something about the author as a character in a book that is important. And I think very often there's a sort of pedantry, if that's the right word, that's funny in your voice.
Oh, that's interesting.
Do you know what I mean?
Not really.
Well, okay, so you were the narrator, the storyteller, will describe something and then undermine it by saying, "Well, it's not really like that." But
oh, that's interesting.
I had to say that, or you know, there's a sort of I think the author is a character in your writing, seems to me to be a thing. I don't know, on my limited awareness, I suppose. And I think that's one of the things that, well, I don't know. I'll let you comment on that. If it's interesting,
I shall have to check that out. I don't know. I get depressed a lot, so that probably comes over in the writing.
Does it?
Yeah, quite lugubrious.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. I mean, I don't think it's depression. Well, I didn't read it as depression in any of the anything I've written of your read of yours. I was reading some of your free stuff on your website, which is a great set of short stories.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I like writing those. But yeah, I wanted to, because to me, there's two types of short stories. There's the sort of the American style where everything's very moody and somebody at the end realizes that it was the happiest day of their life and a load of leaves fall off a tree. Or there's a sort of horror science fiction ones, and I tend towards those. I don't know why.
I think there's something about, it's kind of the constraints of writing, isn't it? That engender creativity. You know, you've got to write it in 500 words.
Yeah. In my writing, I discovered reading a Clive James thing. There's a writer called Contini. I know nothing about them. But he said this great thing that the obstacle is the inspiration. That writing a novel in rhyme isn't a restriction. It's not an obstacle. It will make you write something more interesting. That's why low budget movies are often better, because they force people to concentrate. The new movie, The Dig, I don't know if you've seen that, but
yeah, I've seen it. Yeah,
I loved it. And one of the things you realize is it was filmed under COVID restrictions. So it's very minimal. There are scenes with overlapping dialogue. There's obviously a lot of shots they couldn't get, and it makes the film better because considering it's quite a moody movie, it rattles along.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that if it had been filmed in normal times, but it's still been great, but it would have been more expansive, possibly more rambly, and a bit more lush. So I think restrictions can be really effective.
Yeah, I think that's something that other people have commented on in the sort of present kind of TV world with Netflix and Amazon, that there's almost too much money in some series. You know, they commission too many episodes, and they've got too much time to develop the story.
There's a lot of very long shows, a lot of too many special effects.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, just endless lingering, beautiful golden showers of diamonds, if that is a thing.
I'm sure you know what you mean. But the other thing that struck me about, and particularly reading Night Train, probably setting aside the first chapter for reasons that maybe we can go into, it seems very filmic. Mm. When you're writing, are you thinking of it as a kind of visual medium? Are you seeing it played out in that way, or is it not the case?
I visualize it. I mean, this one, it's hard to say because it was set on a train.
Yeah.
There were certain scenes where you realize you've got rather a lot of things going on in a very confined space. And that was difficult. And I did actually watch, ironically, several films with trains in, like Murder on the Orient Express and Train to Busan, a brilliant Korean horror film, to see what it would be like. But I also managed to miss out another well-known Korean film called Snowpiercer, which has almost exactly the same plot, although their train is really big, so they cheat. They have a specially made future train.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that Night Train would be a great movie. It's just unfortunate that there already is a movie about a bunch of people on a train full of horrors in a post-apocalyptic world moving to the front to confront their destiny.
Oh, there's got to be room for one more, surely.
Well, I hope so. Mine's based on The Wizard of Oz anyway.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
I suppose it is, yeah. Obviously, it hadn't occurred to me, but...
I realised it about halfway through, and then I realised there was a character called Garland, and that was subconscious giveaway. Yes. Wasn't deliberate, but...
Yeah. But equally, I mean, again, The Mule, I haven't read, and I want to. I think... Is it being reprinted at the moment?
Not to my knowledge.
Well,
I mean, I've got a box full in the attic, so they can have those if they need them.
All right. Well, I might ask you for some of those. Yeah. I'm sure our suppliers say that The Mule is considering being reprinted or is being reprinted.
Wow.
So that'd be nice.
That'd be great.
But I think, you know, just looking at the storyline and knowing your approach, that's a movie or a TV series, isn't it? I mean, you want to sell that to Netflix and...
Well, when I wrote it, I thought it could be a movie. I had a few things in mind, but I mean, all my colours, the one before Night Train, I am adapting for a film for a company at the moment, and that is very interesting to do. Doesn't mean it'll get made, but somebody was interested to see a script. And that's weird because it's a lot different. So you think of it like a film, but it's not actually the film that you end up writing.
Mm. Is there a given that you don't want to throw away words, is that quite difficult to change it and edit it and lose things?
No, I mean, Philip Pullman, I read a quote of his when they made the film version of The Golden Compass or whichever one it was, and a lot of people complained about it being very different to the book, and he did point out that if you liked the book, you could always read that.
Yes.
It's a different thing. It's like, I don't really understand this obsession with people like, oh, I want it to be exactly like the book. It's not going to be. You know, it's like when people change facts in films. It's a film.
Yeah.
It's different. So, for example, with All My Colours, the first thing that went was the setting. It was set in the 70s.
Yeah.
Costs a lot of money to film things in the 70s. And that doesn't really bother me, you know. I'm not a museum of the 70s. And so, yeah, dialogue has to change because in a book, well, most of a book isn't dialogue. Most of a book is what's going on in people's heads. And in a film, you can't have that unless you have a boring monologue. What sounds like snappy dialogue written down quite often sounds like a massive mouthful when somebody actually says it. And a film, simply enough, a film is 2 hours long. If you read out a book, it's about 8 hours. So films have to compress. You can't get a sense of action from reading out a book.
I've done what I've done before now. I just realised I haven't actually asked you about your word or given you my word. Did you come along with a word?
Yes, I did.
What was your word then?
Wednesday.
Wednesday. Okay, before I respond to that, I'm going to tell you what my word was.
Okay.
My word was going to be absurdism.
Okay, why is that?
Well, because I was trying to light upon some word that kind of linked together, or at least my reception of your style. And I was trying to think, you know, I think, do people describe your comedy as surreal? Do they describe it as, I don't know. I think absurdism is probably nearer the mark, but I don't know what you think.
Well, I can sort of relate to that because my favourite comedians were the Goons. I always preferred them even to Monty Python. I've always enjoyed surrealism and surreal comedy. So I like surreal writers like Leonora Carrington. I've got some of her stuff. And one of my favourite, all-time favourite writers is a bloke called N.F. Simpson, who was very big playwright in the 50s. I made a documentary about him. And he was often lumped in with the absurdists, which is not something he liked very much. But his comedy is fantastic. He's like sort of an intellectual Spike Milligan in a way.
Oh, I did read something about him recently, actually. Yeah, I think.
Yeah,
something in the paper about him. Maybe in the London Review of Books or something like that recently.
Well, a friend of mine called Ian Greaves has done a great deal of work making sure that N.F. Simpson stuff is in print. Maybe there's something out. But he's one of the greats, an absolute hero of mine. So, yeah, absurdism, as in the actual movement, I'm not a big fan of. It's mostly French people going, think about this, we're all rhinoceroses or something. But actual absurd, I mean, the only people who make me laugh, who literally make me laugh, are Vic and Bob.
Right, good.
Because with absurd comedy, you don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Whereas when you write comedy for a living, an awful lot of the time, you know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I think that's, yes, I think that's, so that's an accurate reflection, I think, of what maybe, I think, your writing does. Because you don't want to be conventional. You're not a joke writer in the sense that, at least that I don't think you are, in the sense that you could write a joke for Michael McIntyre. I don't know, maybe you could. I mean, if he paid you, I guess you would. But, you know, it's much more kind of in keeping with things like Harry Hill's TV Burp, which you contributed to, where it's pointing out, it's not satire in the sense, you know, you're pointing out the ridiculousness of reality, but you're pointing out that everything is bizarre and cracked and doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I think that's true. I've always liked that kind of logic.
And without over-labouring it, I think there's an element of that sort of unexpected twist and turn in Night Train as well.
Yeah.
It's not sci-fi. It's not entirely a horror. You don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know which way it's going to go.
Maybe that's why nobody bought it.
Oh, dear. Well, I'll do my best to promote it. I mean, I did actually recommend it to somebody just before Christmas. They were looking for a present for someone. They were just trying to describe what kind of books they liked and what they'd read before. And I said, well, yeah, try this one. So they did.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Well, it's one book, you know, and I know it's like, 50 pence or something. you published a few of your books through Unbound as well.
Yes, they're very nice people.
Did that work well for you?
Yeah, it did, because I had written The Mule and touted it round, and there had been an agent who was interested, who then became not interested, but that at least gave me the... Anyway, so I got it crowdfunded and it came out and it got reviewed. And that was really good for my confidence, because it helped sales a bit, but it told me that if I wrote a book, somebody might actually like it.
Mm.
So that was brilliant. That gave me confidence, and I wrote another one for them. But it was just the confidence that, you know, I mean, it's exciting to have your own book, but it always feels a bit iffy when it's, you know, a relation of mine, I'm told, once had a book of poems published that they prayed for. And I'd always feel a bit odd about that, because it'd be lovely to have your stuff bound and on your shelf, but also the idea that you paid for it yourself.
Yeah.
It's a bit like hiring someone to praise you, so which I have done. So,
Well, I will send you a copy of my self-published poetry a book.
Well, that would be lovely.
I don't believe you, but you know, it's not. Anyway, I will, but I know what you mean. There's a sort of there's a feeling that, yeah, kind of, what right do you have to inflict this on the world? And the only way the only reason you can do it is because you can afford to get it printed. There is something about that endorsement from an agent or a publisher.
It does help.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't mean, it's like, I put my first book, Sparks, on the internet on an e-novel, my wife's suggestion, and that sells about one copy a month. But that was different for me because that was something that I felt was good and I wanted out there. And it's just the fact that, maybe because it's on the line, but it's out there, and if people do want it, they can get it.
Yeah.
But I wanted it out there because it seemed important to have something public.
And that's another one that sounds like it should be a film.
Yeah, I did write that as a film script once, but nothing happened. It's quite funny, Sparks.
So, a couple of questions. What are there other particular writers? You mentioned Vic and Bob at the moment, who kind of not really doing much at the moment, but are there other sort of comedy people or writers that you are admiring or you watch at the moment?
Nothing comes to mind. I've sort of gone off American. I like Armando's stuff, obviously.
Yeah.
Chris's stuff, when he does it, is very good. But at the moment, me and my wife are mostly watching Korean dramas. They're just great, and they're quite absurd and exciting shows and very funny. But no, I don't know, maybe I'm just a bit jaded of British and American comedies. I did enjoy The Good Place. That was really good. I think American comedy still got a slight edge over British stuff.
Yeah.
I have enjoyed Would I Lie to You? Bob Mortimer's on that.
Yes.
Because again, that's absurd and unexpected.
Hmm.
I'm always on the market for a decent comedy movie. Bits of Borat. Sometimes it's too much for me, but what he does is extraordinary.
In what way is it too much for you?
I'm not going to go into detailed scenes. Some of it's just gross out comedy. I'm quite happy to discuss bodily functions with people, but not always for comedy reasons. Yeah, I don't really like gross out comedy. Yeah. I realise many people do.
Yeah, but you can't please all the people. But coming back to your thing about how to write anything, would you write anything? I mean, any brief, anyone who's paying, you'll write that thing.
If it was an interesting exercise, I mean, there are probably some very few political things I wouldn't do. But, you know, it's like if I was asked to write a speech for Hitler, I'd certainly think about it for a minute just to see what it would be like, but I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I am really interested in how things work. You know, it's like if you're someone who likes building cars, you might be interested in building a terrible car.
Hmm.
So yeah, I'd like to write poems if I could. I don't think I can. I've written wedding speeches for people. I've written t-shirt slogans. It's interesting, all the different formats of writing. And it's just the same for me. It's reading a lot.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to be a writer, you should read everything from soup cans to romantic novels, because you'll learn something, and you'll learn more if you write it.
Yeah. So what are you reading at the moment that you can recommend?
I borrowed an Elizabeth Jane Howard novel off my wife, because Elizabeth Jane Howard's a really good writer.
Mm.
I have got an old book of essays by Jonathan Meads. He's a very stylized writer.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to read his stuff, and because it's historical context as well.
Yeah.
I just read an old Stephen King novel called Cycle of the Werewolf. You can guess what that was about. Yeah, that's pretty much my recent reading.
So do you have a big pile of books next to your bed?
I do, and then I give up on most of them after a while. Like a lot of people nowadays, you read a couple of pages and think, this isn't for me.
Yeah. I do tend to persist with books that I find difficult. I mean, particularly books that have been recommended or, have some kind of historical weight behind them. I'm reading something by George Simenon at the moment.
Oh, good.
I can't remember what it is. It's a sort of collection of it. Oh, it's, I think it's his diaries.
Oh, interesting.
And but they're kind of written almost deliberately not to be interesting. I was reading a review of them that I don't think he ever went back and corrected them or edited them for publication. It was just so in the course of writing it, he'd obviously often go back and say, "Well, I know I said that, but I didn't mean that." And it all happened very differently, but I can't bother to go back. And, you know, that's kind of – so I had to persist with that a bit because I don't really know much about him. Mm. But I think you're right. You know, the more you read and the more you understand – I think one of the things it does, reading lots of stuff, is it kind of reassures you that what you write is okay, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, I read A Swim in the Pond in the Rain by George Saunders.
All right.
Which is, you know, he wrote Lincoln in the Bardo and he's a lecturer. Yeah. And this is a book where he goes through some Russian short stories and analyzes them. And it's kind of a book about writing and a book about, it's a useful book for people who want to write because it gives you writing hints as well.
All right.
And there was just one bit that really, a couple of bits that really resonated with me. And one was a quote from some writer basically saying, when a writer sits down, they should not know what to write. And I really agree with that. I don't like over-planning. And you're talking about absurdism in Night Train. Mm. And I think a lot of that is because you get to a point and you're like, what happens next? I know, a robot bear attacks them.
Yes.
And it's much more interesting to me than writing a list and going, chapter 9, robot bear.
Yeah. But I think that's right because it comes back to the constraints, doesn't it? You know, you throw something in that almost you didn't expect.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to deal with it.
It's like you get to chapter 9 and there's a door and you know that all they have to do is go through the door and escape, and you write chapter 9, the door turns into a dog and bites them. But the trick is to not actually have worked out what happens next. Just go, get out, and just say to yourself, get out of that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Before I forget then, why Wednesday?
Wednesday because... A, because the first time I was asked to do this by someone, people always pick slightly wry words or, you know, the kind of people who like A Murder of Crows or A Parliament of... There's a kind of slight literary tweeness to certain words.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, absurd isn't accurate. That's good.
Okay.
So there's that. But also Wednesday is a day that I really like. When I was a kid, I went to a school which had Wednesday afternoons off, and my dad would give me money to go to a Greek cafe on my own where I would have omelette and chips and a Coke. And I've always rather associated Wednesdays with that sense of freedom and omelettes.
Mm.
So, yeah, also Wednesday is a really good word.
It is a good word, yeah.
It just is.
It is, true. And of course, it gives you that joke about the academic who was given his timetable for the next term, and he was told he was teaching on a Wednesday, and he said, well, I don't want to work on a Wednesday. And they said, why not? He said, because it ruins two weekends.
I don't get it at all.
Oh, okay. No, well, I'll edit it.
What does it mean?
Working on a Wednesday ruins two weekends, the weekend before and the weekend afterward. No,
I really don't. I don't understand that. That's exciting. No. I'm so sorry.
No, it's not. It's fine. It's fine. It's really about the indolence of academics. But,
oh, I see. But, oh, right. Yeah. I mean, I can relate. I could relate to that now. Academics being what they are, but no. At least I've heard a joke about Wednesday. They're not very common.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely edit that out.
Just put in some laughter from a record.
Anyway, listen, I've kept you for an hour, but I've enjoyed it. And I've enjoyed being able to tell you what I think about Night Train, which I really enjoyed. And as I say, I genuinely did sit down one evening and read it from cover to cover, not because I had to, but because I wanted to. So thank you.
Oh, that's really kind. Well, thank you.
Not at all. And yes, we'll definitely talk about getting copies of the Mule and other things, and hope we can spread the word.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me know and I'll send you one.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Well, that was awkward, wasn't it? But anyway, after we stopped recording, David said how much he enjoyed the conversation, and I'd enjoyed it as well, apart from that moment. I think it took David a while to warm up, because I think you'd describe his character as dry, but he's very clever and very funny, and one day it'd be great to get him back to talk more about the craft of writing. Hopefully we can persuade him to come up from his home to Tunbridge to talk about the skills of writing. You can check out some links to his books, books that we mentioned as well, in the information for this podcast, this episode. And even now, we've got another tremendous guest lined up. So be sure to subscribe here on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts, so you don't miss it. And remember, Ideas in Writing is supported by Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, home of independent, inspiring and imaginative books, gifts and conversation, including an exclusive range of book-related and Mr. Books-inspired T-shirts. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. You just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment. But it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts, so thank you very much.